A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, on July 14, 1991, in the series The Footprints of God in the Sands of Time, entitled Providence, Personality, and Power. The scripture readings are Exodus 2, verses 1 through 15, and chapter 3, verses 1 through 6. The text for the sermon is Exodus 3, verses 4 through 5 and 14. Copyright, Grand Valley State University.
Wasn't at all what they expected to find. To say they were disappointed would be an understatement. While they were still in Babylon in the state of exile, they had been fired with the vision of the prophet we call 2nd Isaiah, the prophet whose writings we have in Isaiah 40 to 66. And now they had returned and they were there in Jerusalem, back home again, and not at all what they really wanted to find. They rummaged through the ruins and the rubble, and they wondered how in the world it would be possible to reconcile the wonder of the vision and the disaster of the actuality. They poked through the ruins that had one time been walls, and they had visions of the grandeur of Solomon's temple, another temple coming in its place, but lacking the glory. How could it be that they could have been so charged with that vision of the prophet and now find themselves in this dismal state, in a situation, in spite of the vision, that didn't seem to have a prayer? What were the prophet's words again? Comfort ye, my people, says your God. In the desert, make a highway for the king. Every valley shall be lifted up and every mountain brought low. Get you up into a high mountain, say to the cities of Jerusalem, of Judah, behold, your God is here. Here in this rubble and rubbish and ruin, where, pray tell, the prophet who had energized them, the vision that had captivated them, the reality that depressed them, and how could they make sense of it? For do we not constantly have to try to reconcile the vision with reality? The aspiration and the dream with the real data that confronts us as plain as the nose on our face. The author of the book of Exodus struggled to understand who they were, what God had called them to be. Where did the prophet get his vision? What had energized him to dream that dream? Wasn't it? Yes, that was it. The prophet had made references to the Exodus, to the founding of the nation, to that movement of a band of slaves out of Egypt and through the wilderness and into the promised land. It was the Exodus that was the model of the prophet's vision of return, the Exodus. And therefore, the prophet's deep assurance that the God who had called them into being was the God who would not forsake them in exile, that the gods of Babylon were really no gods. If only this one sitting in the ruins of a Jerusalem that would be born again could recapture the sense of what had happened. Where did the prophet feed his soul? Ah, in those stories of Moses, the sagas of the founding of the nation. That's where the prophet had gone to find again the vision and to restore his own faith in the purposes of God. The prophet who wrote, "Have no fear, for I have paid your ransom. I have called you by name, and you are mine. And when you pass through deep waters, I am with you. And when you pass through rivers, they will not sweep you away. Walk through fire, and you will not be scorched, and through flames, and they will not consume you. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your deliverer." That was the one that had filled the mind and the heart of the prophet as he had energized the people who had returned with visions of glory and grandeur. This God who said, "Cease to dwell on days gone by and to brood over past history. Here and now I will do a new thing. This moment it will break from the bud. Can you not perceive it? I have formed this people for myself, and they shall proclaim my praise. I alone am God, who for my own sake wipes away all of your transgressions and remembers your sin no more." 515 BC, reaching back 750 years to the founding of the nation, this one sits in the middle of the ruin and the rubble and the rubbish of a city whose glory seems to be behind it, and tries to capture again that sense that there is someone beyond Pharaoh's gods, someone beyond the pomp and circumstance of Nebuchadnezzar's court, someone, some power, some plan, some purpose in the midst of life with all of its contingency and its ambiguity and all of its pain and darkness and tragedy. Is God at all? And is God aware? And if God is, does God care? And so he went back again and fed his soul on the saga of Moses, the boy, baby, who was set afloat in the Nile, who was discovered by Pharaoh's daughter, who was nurtured by his own mother, raised in all of the pomp of Egypt's culture and civilization, only to become an official in that great world civilization. One day, in his supervisory capacity, coming upon an Egyptian taskmaster brutalizing a Hebrew, and Moses looked, and Moses saw. He saw through. He sensed that brutalizing of that Hebrew, his kinfolk, was something that must violate all that was right and true and good. And in an impulse, in a moment, with a visceral reaction, he rose up and he killed the Egyptian. And as the adrenaline began to recede, he began to tremble, for he realized that his response to the violence and the brutality of the Egyptian was an equal response of violence taking a human life. And he looked around, scared to death, threw some sand over the body, and left, hoping that no one had seen. But the next day it was clear enough that in the Hebrew camp they knew of it, and if they knew of it, then Pharaoh knew of it. And Moses gave a road to his feet and fled into the wilderness of Midian, shaken to the core. And finding there a safe haven with Jethro, whose daughter he married and whose sheep he tended, He spent a year and two and three and a decade and two and three tending sheep, which was the task of the women and children, having it not within himself to join the men to become a warrior. He had killed and he couldn't kill again. Shaken to the core, ashen white, he brooded in the solitude of the wilderness, which is the place of non-being, trying to understand himself. And that impulsive, violent act certainly in a bit of time, it would be washed out of his psyche. For he had been schooled in the traditional wisdom and knowledge of Egypt. He had the finest of education. He was totally enculturated. Certainly, slaves, be they Hebrew or not, slaves or chattel, objects to be used and, if need be, abused. All of the conventional answers began to click into Moses' mind and heart as he tried to get beyond that experience, that violent moment, which had changed the course of his life. But he never could quite get beyond it. Never could fully put that moment behind him. And there were times when he knew that although taking that life was wrong, yet he was right. For no human being is to be treated as an object. Slavery is wrong. An institution that sanctions slavery is wrong. Gods that sanction slavery, human brutality, cruelty, oppression, those gods can be no gods. Have you ever had a thought, an insight, an illuminating moment when suddenly you knew something so clearly, but it was so contrary to all of the conventional wisdom, the folkways and the mores of all of society about you that you quickly put the thought out of your mind, refused to acknowledge the truth of it, knowing that if you would acknowledge the truth of it, you would change your life. You would have to change your life. You would have to reorder everything. And knowing the cost of that, rather to blot out the vision, block out the truth, put it away, stick within those narrow hedgerows that make for safety and security, that make society manageable. But that kind of moment can never be washed out of one's mind, and it will never be denied in the core of one's being. For we all believe two things. We believe the conventions to which we all agree. We believe them with our head. We live by them. We do obeisance to them. We bow before them. We don't seriously question them. We never really admit that we have any serious doubt about them. But there's something else that we believe. We believe it in the visceral section. And what we believe here will always, every time, overcome what we believe here. And what we believe here is not what we really believe. It's what we believe here. Moses killed the Egyptian because something that he believed here. and try as he may for the next decades to get this to wipe out this. It was impossible. He was a man ripe for a vision and a voice. And so, when he looked at the bush, and it seemed to be burning but was not consumed, he stepped aside to see it. One wonders if there was a bush at all, if any bush burned at all, or whether it was finally the eruption of the inside of a man who had a vision of truth and a longing for reality in God, whose insides simply broke open in a conflagration that could only have been ignited by God, if God there be, some God beyond the gods of humankind, all of the idols before whom the Egyptians and the Midianites and the Canaanites and the Amorites bow and worship, some God who would be worthy of God, some God who wouldn't sanction human slavery and human oppression and the coercion and the manipulation of people as though they were chattel. Some God who would say, go, set my people free. But you don't emerge from decades of solitude brooding over the core of your being where the battle rages, and then suddenly raise your flag and march off. You say, who are you? And strangely enough, the very one that one had been seeking without knowing says, I am with you. And you say, why? Why me? And the voice says, because I see, I hear. The anguish of their cries has reached me. I know, in the biblical sense of sharing an experience with, I am suffering in the cauldron of Egypt in the experience of my people. That's why, go. And Moses went and led the first freedom flight, just a band of slaves who became a people, who became a nation. A nation that knew moments of glory and splendor and moments of disaster. A nation that in 515 BC had somebody poking around the rubble and the ruins and the rubbish saying, has this got any meaning? Is there someone, is there a power, a purpose, a plan? Well, I don't know. Because of a floating cradle on the Nile, and a Hebrew child raised in Egyptian culture, a murderer, exiled and returned, who led a band of slaves to freedom, there was Israel, from whom came Jesus, to whom you owe the shape of your spiritual existence. Might Moses had said, no, I suppose so. He might have said, as Freud has said, it's all an illusion. You've been brooding too long alone. And now that which is eating up your insides and giving you visions and causing you to hear voices is an illusion. It might be, you know. And then there are those who would say, who can say? Who all of their life simply plead ignorance. I don't know. I don't know. And then there are some who really don't know either, but who take the risk of faith and dare to follow the dream and to pursue the vision. And they change the world. And so in the ruin and the rubble and the rubbish of a city whose glory was behind it, this one poking around in the saga of the founding of his people, heard again the words of the prophet who had the vision. Fear not, for I am with you. I am your God. Be not dismayed. And when you go through the waters, they will not overwhelm you, and through the rivers, they will not sweep you away. When you walk through the flame, it will not burn you, and through the fire, you'll not be consumed. For I am the Lord your God, the Holy One of Israel, your Savior. And I suppose that all of our life, in all of our circumstances, we'll be moving between those times when we're ready to throw up our hands and feel it's an illusion, and those moments when we just honestly say, I don't know. And then those times in deep waters or in the midst of the flame when that word becomes concrete experience and the Holy One of Israel says, I am with you. More than that, in all honesty, I do not dare offer you. But that is enough. The God who says, come hell or high water, I will be with you. Thank God.